Good evening or good afternoon to you all. My name is Carmen Fazzo. I am the co-chair, along with Professor Volker Thiel, of the MCID, Multidisciplinary Center for Infectious Diseases, a new strategic center based at the University of Bern. This is our first Twitter space, and it will be dedicated to monkeypox and everything we'd like to know about it, what it is that we do know about it, what it is that we don't know about it. And we have a panel of experts with us today. At this point, I'd like to hand over to Dr. Christian Althaus, who shall chair today's event and who has co-host rights. Christian, I'm handing over to you while trying to get all of our speakers on board as speakers rather than listeners. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Carmen, for the introduction. I hope everyone can hear us, and a warm welcome to the audience of this first Twitter Spaces that we are having for the MCID. So excuse a few hiccups that might happen during the next 60 minutes or so. Yes, while we are still kind of occupied with the public health response of the ongoing pandemic of COVID-19, the last weeks or months have shown the emergence of another infectious disease that requires a multidisciplinary approach in its public health response, and this is monkeypox. Monkeypox is not entirely new. It was identified in the 50s in a monkey, that's hence the name, and then in 1970 for the first time in humans. And due to the stop of the smallpox vaccination programs in the 70s and the 80s, it was kind of expected that there is the possibility for wider spread of monkeypox, and that's possibly what we are seeing now. To date, we have a little bit more than 4,700 confirmed cases in dozens of countries globally. 81 of these cases are reported in Switzerland. And how it came to this and what it means for the public health response and for different communities that are affected, we are going to discuss and hear about from our experts. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce really a wonderful lineup of experts that we could assemble for this Twitter space. We'll start with Emma Hotcroft. Emma is a genomic epidemiologist at the Institute of Social and Preventive Medicine at the University of Bern and a member of MCID. She will talk to us about the origin and genomics of monkeypox. Afterwards, we'll have Katrin Summermatter. She is the head of the Biosafety Center at the University of Bern, also a member of the MCID and a member of the Emergency Committee regarding the multi-country outbreak of monkeypox. She will talk about monkeypox diagnostics. Then we'll head over to our guest from Germany, Aziza Volz. She's a virologist at the University of Veterinary Medicine in Hannover. She will talk to us about immunity and vaccination. Then we'll have Nicola Lowe, epidemiologist at the University of Bern, again, a member of MCID and the vice chair of the Emergency Committee regarding the multi-country outbreak of monkeypox. She will talk to us about monkeypox transmission and especially the role of sexual networks and sexual transmission. And then finally, I'm really glad to have Florian Fock with us. Florian is a team manager for key populations case and other MSM at AIDS-Hilfe Schweiz, that's the Swiss AIDS Federation, and he will talk to us about information campaigns and prevention. So I don't want to spend more time on the introduction, and we can go straight to the first short talk from Emma Hotcroft about the origin and genomics of monkeypox. Emma, over to you.
Thank you so much, Christian, and it's a real pleasure to be here today for this MCID Twitter Spaces event. And I just wanted to start off by talking a little bit about the genetics of the monkeypox virus. One thing that you may have heard, but is worth repeating, is that monkeypox is a DNA virus. So this means that it behaves and works a little bit different from SARS-CoV-2, which a lot of people, of course, have heard a lot about. So for example, one thing is that it mutates much slower than SARS-CoV-2, which people might find a little bit comforting considering some of the challenges this has posed to the current pandemic. Now, monkeypox is also a pretty old virus. It's been around for quite a while. And so we do have some sequences that go back many decades, which means we do have a little bit of an idea of how much diversity there is out there. And for example, we have some information about how that's changed over time and how different outbreaks that have jumped from animals into humans at different points have differed slightly from each other. In general, we consider that there's three different deep clades that's similar to kind of variants in SARS-CoV-2, but a little bit more different of monkeypox. So clade 1, 2, and 3. And a lot of the previous outbreaks from animals into humans have been from clade 1 and clade 2, but the current outbreak is actually part of clade 3. And we've seen some interesting things in the sequences that we've had from more recent sequences that we've seen, including the current outbreak, in that these have often clustered together as part of the ancestry of clade 3 that's led to the current outbreak. So for example, we've seen sequences from different countries around the world that likely have been animal to human spillovers, but seem to be ancestors of the current outbreak. The current outbreak sequences, or sequences from people who've been diagnosed, kind of since people have been hearing about monkeypox in the last couple of months, cluster together really tightly. They're definitely all genetically related to each other and quite similar to each other as well. But we have also seen some sequences that came out about a month ago that you may have seen on Twitter or in headlines from the US that give us a more historic look. So they include some direct ancestors to the current outbreak, which might help us to better figure out how this virus has evolved more recently, what might have led to the current outbreak that we see, and what changes have happened in the meantime. Now, one thing that you've almost certainly heard about, I know there's been some headlines about this recently, is the mutation rate of the virus. And in particular, there's been some headlines saying that monkeypox is mutating faster than expected. So at face value, this is true. We see more mutations between the ancestors to the current outbreak and the current outbreak sequences than we would expect in that timeframe. So because we know how quickly viruses mutate, we can estimate about how many mutations we tend to see per year. And we do actually see many more than we would expect in the last couple of years in this outbreak lineage. Now, what's really important, though, is that this is something that sounds really, really alarming. And I think some of the headlines haven't necessarily helped that. But actually, the actual mutations that we see can tell us something about how they've happened. And what they actually look like is scars. I think Richard Nair first kind of coined that, saying that these are scars from attacks by antiviral systems. So all animals have ways to fight off viruses. And one way that does this is a mechanism called ApoBec, which we think might be what's causing this damage here, that essentially just tries to randomly mutate the virus so that it breaks. You're more likely to break something by hitting it randomly than make it better. And so we think that a lot of these mutations are actually remnants from those antiviral systems. And therefore, we don't necessarily expect them to be adaptive, as in we don't necessarily expect that they help the virus. And so in that case, a lot of these might be giving us some good signal to see how the sequences are changing, but are not necessarily responsible for changing how the virus works. So of course, we need to examine all of these mutations to really understand if any of them could be impacting the different transmission dynamics we see in this outbreak. Finally, one of the kind of promising things we've seen from this faster mutation rate is that even though these are very likely not adaptive, they are allowing us to get a little bit of resolution in the sequences we see from this outbreak. So we can actually see some clusters of some of the sequences that we're getting from all around the world. And this may also help us to better understand how the virus is moving, how it's transmitting between people, how widespread it is, and perhaps even how long it may have been transmitting human to human. And so that elevated mutation rate, especially if it's not something that's helping the virus, could actually be something that helps us to better understand this outbreak. So for that, that's a really quick summary of what we can tell from the genetics so far. And I'll hand back to Christian for the next speech.
Thank you so much, Emma, for this wonderful overview on the origins and genomics of monkeypox. I forgot to mention, we have a dedicated hashtag called MCID monkeypox. So if you like to write down questions that we might pick up for the discussion that will follow this presentation, please use this hashtag. We'll follow that And if you're out of time during this event, we try to respond at least to some of these questions afterwards directly on Twitter. So having said that, I'm really excited to hand over to our next speaker. This is Katrin Sumamato, head of the Biosafety Center at the University of Bern, and she will talk about monkeypox diagnostics.
Good evening, everybody. It's really a pleasure to be here and to talk a little bit about monkeypox. And I would like to take you into the lab field and the lab environment, not really talking about monkeypox itself, but as so far only a few labs were handling monkeypox, it was not really a concern, and many countries were not necessarily be prepared to handle larger volumes of diagnostic samples. So few cases were mainly related to travel to endemic regions, which were easily handled by the national reference lab. So far, fortunately, there was no laboratory acquired infection known by monkeypox. And we also have, when we are talking about monkeypox, we also have to have a look at smallpox, because since smallpox eradication, vaccination stopped, so certain countries, they just have some stockpiles for in case of emergencies. So, and as you may all know, smallpox labs, there is only two labs worldwide. One is in Atlanta at CDC in the United States, and the second one is in Vector Novosibirsk in Russia. So both of these two labs, they are also very expert. They have a lot of expertise in handling monkeypox viruses. And smallpox labs, they are always inspected by an international expert team, by the WHO. And the goal is all the time, every time, to oversee biosafety and biosecurity and to determine whether the world is safe. So could, for example, a smallpox outbreak from this lab trigger a pandemic or an epidemic in a certain region. So laboratory acquired infections still happen, but as I mentioned so far, fortunately no monkeypox infection is known. This may be due to the fact that only a few labs were involved in monkeypox research and diagnostics, or because people are much more aware about the risks that they encounter if they are working in a lab. So the last laboratory-associated infection with smallpox happened in Birmingham in 1978, where a police photographer, Janet Parker, sadly was infected with smallpox and died. About 250 persons had to be quarantined after. So the reason was that the building in which also smallpox was handled in other parts didn't meet the safety requirements anymore. So WHO also inspected that lab at that time, and the recommendation was to close the lab or to completely renovate it. But unfortunately, the leader, the head of the lab, didn't really follow the procedure, and this led to this death. So laboratory infections with a close relative to monkeypox virus, vaccinia viruses, happened several times over the past few years. And fortunately, only individual cases happened, which means there were no secondary cases and it was not passed along to other household members. So typically, if somebody is working with these viruses in the lab, be it on the diagnostic side or be it on the research side, so a proper risk assessment has to be done. And unfortunately, fortunately, there would be a vaccination available, but Switzerland is not enough vaccines available to vaccinate all its lab staff. And at the moment, there is a lot of discussions also on an international level, because many of the bigger organizations, they highly recommend vaccinating all the personnel that is involved in handling these viruses. So with that, I would like to close, and then I'm looking forward for future discussions. Thank you.
Thank you, Katrin, for a wonderful overview on diagnostics. I think these are really interesting and pressing questions. We head over to Aziza Foltz from Germany, who will talk to us about immunity and vaccination.
Thanks, Christian. Good evening, everybody, and thank you for having me in that Twitter space and to talk about my favorite viruses, or about pox viruses. So, and when we talk about monkeypox virus and vaccination, we are in the lucky situation that due to a high antigenic cross-reactivity between pox viruses, the smallpox vaccines also protect against monkeypox virus. And this is quite beneficial because the smallpox vaccines are very well characterized, and we know the smallpox vaccines for quite a long time. To say the smallpox vaccine has been the first vaccine to be developed by Edward Jenner, and he demonstrated that an infection with a relatively mild cowpox virus induced protection against the lethal variola virus, so the causative agent of human smallpox. And from this on, cowpox virus served as a natural vaccine until the next generation smallpox vaccines emerged in the 20th century as improved and more safe vaccines. And with advances in molecular biology, these modern small
too far, sorry. So we had been with the modern smallpox vaccine, and the fact that with the molecular biology had been identified this modern smallpox vaccines as vaccinia virus, another member of the orthopox viruses. And this replication competent vaccinia virus has been then used during the smallpox eradication campaign as vaccine. And interestingly, it was quite obvious that vaccinia virus vaccination is also associated with some and also some severe side effects. So, and this induced efforts to further improve vaccinia virus as smallpox vaccine. And this finally resulted in the development of the third generation smallpox vaccines. And these third generation smallpox vaccines represent a more attenuated and even more safe version of the classical vaccinia virus. And the promising candidate here that is already licensed in North America and Europe as smallpox vaccine is the modified vaccinia virus Ankara, MVA. And MVA is a highly attenuated and replication deficient vaccinia virus. And so MVA really has a high safety range and can even be used in immunocompromised persons. And this is also the vaccine that is now used in that current monkeypox virus outbreak to stop spreading of the virus. It's the only licensed vaccine we have at the moment. So, and another positive effect of that vaccination campaign is that people that got vaccinated with vaccinia virus 40 years ago or even more years ago still mount a vaccinia virus specific immune response. And this is also quite beneficial because here the hypothesis is that due to the antigenic cross-reactivity, this long-term persistent immune response should also protect against monkeypox virus now. So at least a partial protection and avoid the severe disease outcome. So this is what we could also take now in advantage in that outbreak. So, and for our vaccination strategies, at the moment, the focus is on the post-exposure prophylaxis of infected persons and also contact persons, and then to vaccinate people that are at risk to get vaccinated, so target population. And then we could also proceed with ring vaccination programs. And I think the chance that we all get vaccinated against monkeypox virus in the next 5 to 10 years is relatively low due to that specificity of transmission of monkeypox virus that requires a close physical contact. So I think this is not in view. So with that, I thank you for the attention. And sorry for the interruption.
Thanks, Aziza, for these great insights into immunity and vaccination. And I'm sure we'll have a number of questions afterwards that we can address. But first, we move next to Nicola Lowe. She's also from the University of Bern. And she will talk to us about transmission of monkeypox and the role of sexual networks. Over to you, Nicola.
Thank you very much, Christian. And it's a pleasure really to take part in my first Twitter space and for it to be on monkeypox. I would like to switch now to the people who are actually getting infected with monkeypox and to talk about some of the things that are uncharacteristic about the outbreak that we're seeing now and to try and turn that around to looking about how well and why monkeypox has become so widely spread in a wide range of countries right now, and lead on to what that might say for what is the kind of research that we need to do. And after that, when Florian Vock will talk about actually talking about the current situation and prevention. But before we get there, we really want to understand why now, and why is it that we are saying that this outbreak, this multi-country outbreak, is unique. And the first thing to say about that is that monkeypox is not a new disease, but it is the way in which it's transmitting that appears to be new, in that whilst human-to-human transmission of monkeypox has been recognized in endemic countries in West and Central Africa, those cases seem to be relatively limited in relatively short chains of onward transmission. And what's been happening since May of 2022 is that there has been sustained transmission between humans. So not cases originally coming from the animal reservoir of monkeypox, but it has appeared in a human population and between humans is being transmitted, and is being transmitted within countries and then is being transmitted to other countries. That's what really makes it unique. But what also appears to be the case is that there are clinical presentations that seem to differ from the presentations that we have read about and heard about from countries in endemic countries in Western Central Africa, such that what we may call the classical presentations are appearing very, very different. Whereas it is described in the literature and in clinical images as an infection and a disease that presents with some systematic prodrome, headache, fever, malaise, followed by the outbreak of a pustular rash. Amongst people who are getting infected at the moment in non-endemic countries, there are quite a lot of cases that are presenting only with the pustular or skin lesions, and presenting either with a prodrome, it's not a prodrome, then with systemic symptoms coming later or sometimes not at all. And in quite a lot of cases, with not very severe clinical presentation. So the spectrum of infection, it appears to be extremely wide, going from, in fact, asymptomatic in a couple of case reports to very, very florid and much more typical presentations. And to and in fact, there has been a death in the recent past amongst someone who was severely immunocompromised in Nigeria. So the mode of transmission and the clinical presentations seem to be quite different. In this outbreak, at the moment, it is most of the people who are being affected and are becoming infected are in communities of gay and bisexual and other men who have sex with men in non-endemic countries. And in these communities at the moment, as we see the numbers of cases increasing into the thousands across more than 60 countries, the reproduction number in this community is sustaining transmission above one. So every person on average infecting more than one other person. Now, why is it that it's being transmitted so well in these networks? And I have a few points to make. One is that there are sort of quite close and connected social networks of gay and bisexual men who have sex with men. It's the summer. There are a lot of gatherings, open-air gatherings, where people can meet. And the people who are meeting those places, and these events are taking place in different countries. So people are traveling internationally and then maybe becoming infected and then traveling back to their own countries. And the reasonably long incubation period, a couple of weeks before you would get any symptoms, means that you could be in your country and then develop symptoms and then have transmit to other people. So it's spreading widely and into a number of different countries. But another characteristic of the people who are getting infected is that at these, you know, social music and social events, these are largely attended by young people. And as we've heard from our previous speakers, they are not people who've been vaccinated against smallpox. So they have no immunity, not even sort of waned immunity. They are completely susceptible to this orthopox virus. And so it provides a lot of opportunities in a completely new and susceptible population for spread to carry on. Now, how is it being transmitted? What the big link that was being made was that an infection that appears in gay and bisexual men who have sex with men must be being transmitted through sexual contact. And here we have to be a bit nuanced about the language that we use. So monkeypox virus in itself is not what we would classically say is a sexually transmitted disease, meaning that the primary mode of transmission is not through sexual intercourse, but it is being transmitted in the context of sexual contacts. So you could say that it is either sexually transmissible or it's being described as being sexually associated. And the reason for that is that it appears not to require penetrative sexual intercourse for transmission, but that if you have close skin-to-skin contact, this is the real mode of transmission between humans, is that it's close skin-to-skin contact. And so if you have large gatherings where there are many people and there's a lot of close skin-to-skin contact, then you will be able to pass on monkeypox virus. So I want to sort of turn this around to bring it onto the research agenda, because there's a very, very big research agenda of what we do and we don't know about the transmission and transmission modes of monkeypox virus at the moment. And I believe that there is going to turn out to be quite a close link between the types of sexual contact that people are having, so close skin-to-skin contact, the infectious dose that you receive. So if you receive your infectious dose from a person who does not have a large number of lesions, so you have quite a small infectious dose, through a portal of entry that is the skin rather than a mucous membrane, so rather than the mouth, rather than the rectum, we can talk about that, then if, through skin-to-skin contact, you may have a relatively small infectious dose and you may actually have a relatively mild clinical course. There are, in this clinical spectrum, severe cases where people have had very, very florid and unpleasant and incredibly painful lesions. And it is possible that there, that the inoculum, the infectious dose, is increasing. So if you have, if you, in the classical situation where you would be have an infection coming from a rodent, where you get a bite that is immediately parenteral. On the other hand, if you have a smaller infectious dose, it may lead to mild disease. But if you have an infectious dose that comes, you know, maybe through your through the mouth or is transmitted through large numbers of infectious particles from the respiratory tract, or indeed through penetrative sex from lesions on the penis. We've seen a lot of quite a lot of men who have sex with men with quite florid proctitis. It's suggesting that it's something to do with the mode of transmission and the portal of entry and the infectious dose. So I think I'm going to finish there, because there really is a lot to say and a lot of questions to ask about how we might investigate these modes of transmission. But I think it's time to pass on to how we're actually dealing with the situation that we're seeing as it is now in Switzerland and other countries. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Nicola, for these thoughts on transmission. And that nicely leads over to our final speaker, Florian Fock, who will talk about the information and prevention campaigns in Switzerland. Over to you, Florian.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. And always when I hear my last name in English, I realize I work in the right environment. So I will talk a bit about prevention. We have currently in Switzerland 81 confirmed cases. That is not extremely much, but it's going up very clearly and on a daily basis. Almost all of those cases involve gay men or men who were out in the context of gay subculture and gay sex culture. Many of these cases, and Nicola already talked about a bit, many of these cases seem also to have co-infections with chlamydia and gonorrhea. So all this, these facts are very important for us. MPX is not a sexually transmitted infection, but MPX is transmitted in context of physical proximity. And gay culture is one of very physical proximity. So I kiss my friends on the mouth as a greeting. We dance half naked in clubs. And many of us have more sex with more changing partners than average. So that's all facts very helpful for monkeypox virus. And all of this leads to greater exposure for gay men to an infection. But also another fact is true, this community, this gay community, especially in Europe, but also in other countries of this world, gay communities are very and incomparably more competent when it comes to health literacy. So maybe that's also a reason why we see so many cases. Gay men present themselves very quickly to medical specialists when they have symptoms. So what have we done so far? We have informed our community. I cannot show anything here, but check out Dr. Gay on Instagram, TikTok, or drgay.ch/mpx. We spread prevention messages with digital and analog channels. We work with local health centers, sexual health centers like the checkpoints, and we do a lot of outreach prevention work within the gay community and also with the gay community. So we cooperate with the gay umbrella organizations in Switzerland. For us, one thing is very clear. It would be dangerous if we remain vague. So we try to be very clear about what we know. And we also communicate very clear that gay men are especially exposed at the moment. So we do recommendations. And we also see no reason to hide the specific vulnerability for gay men, just out of fear of stigmatizations. We no longer live like in the 80s. Nevertheless, we must be a bit careful, because even if the communication, it seems to us, it's not very homophobic, the measures could be. So there were, I think, within some European countries, brief thoughts that we should go to repressive, kind of old public health measures. close gay saunas, cancel pride events, shut down clubs. And what we also already seeing today in Switzerland, with the threat of a long time of isolation, up to 3 weeks, people are refusing to take the test. And that is, for us, for prevention, very dangerous. So even if there are no closed saunas at the moment, even there is no 3 week isolation recommendation in Switzerland, these ideas have already been established in Mainz, and men are now afraid of being tested. So here we have to take a very clear position. Neither the severity of the disease nor its prevalence would legitimize such repressive measures. And it would have disastrous consequences for prevention, and it would also jeopardize our credibility. So to conclude, what do we need now in Switzerland? We need resources, which is money, to inform the community. We need, and this is very important and sadly not really discussed, we need access to free and easy testing. We need access to treatment, which is not available in Switzerland. We need access to vaccination, which is not available in Switzerland. And we have to stay calm and cool. I mean, MPIX, that's very annoying. It sucks. But we shouldn't make a mistake in kind of a hysterical mixing of experiences from AIDS and experiences from Corona. MPIX is new. It's different. It's a virus where we must once again look at it with a fresh eye. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Florian, for this final contribution. I think we've got really a great overview over these different topics. And with that, the floor is open to the discussion. Again, you can use our dedicated hashtag, MCID Monkeypox, to address your questions on Twitter, but you can also raise your hand or basically ask to speak directly on Twitter Space. I'd like to start with a question from Tom Wenceleers from Belgium that he posted on Twitter using the hashtag. I think that's probably best directed to Emma Hotcroft. First, he asks about the mutations, if that we see in the virus in response to ApoBec, if mutations seen help evade ApoBec attacks, does that not mean that they are adaptive? Emma, could you elaborate a bit more on that, maybe?
Yes, I'm happy to. And this is a great question from Tom, and possibly a bit of lack of clarity on my part while trying to keep to my 5-minute time limit. So the mutations that we see currently, we can tell that the reason that we believe that they're ApoBec attacks is because they follow a really specific pattern. And so we do believe that most of the mutations we see, because they fall in this very specific change in a very specific pattern, there because of ApoBec. But Tom is absolutely right that what the virus is very likely doing at the same time is trying to change those distinct patterns that ApoBec looks for so that it can't be attacked by ApoBec. These are a little bit harder to find because obviously they won't look like an ApoBec pattern afterwards. And so they don't necessarily stand out as clearly. But yes, if the virus is changing its pattern so that ApoBec can't see them anymore, that would certainly be adaptive. But most of the mutations that we've seen do fit this ApoBec pattern. One other thing that's worth clarifying is that this implies that a lot of them may not be adaptive, but it doesn't mean that they definitely aren't. We would still expect the majority probably are not adaptive, but it certainly can happen that it could be an ApoBec-induced mutation that by chance also helps the virus. And that may, of course, be why we see it, because it turns out it is helpful at the same time. So hopefully that gives some clarity to that very good question.
Thanks, Emma. Tom raised another question regarding different variants. Does monkeypox variants circulate with all strains in some parts of Africa? And would that allow us to estimate the relative fitness of this variant? So are these new variants that we see in Europe or Northern America, do we see them already circulating at a larger scale in Central or West Africa? Do you know more about that, Emma?
So this is another, of course, excellent question from Tom. And this is something that would be really interesting to know. Of course, most of what we know from the other variants or the other clades or other strains of monkeypox is that they haven't been transmitting human to human. At least we don't have evidence that they've been doing that. And so therefore, we would consider that the relative fitness of this new outbreak, this new variant that we tend to call, or that has been preliminarily named B.1, that it is more fit because it's transmitting human to human. And so between humans, that would be a more fit trait. But it's also worth considering that we don't necessarily have a good idea of what else might be circulating at low levels, if there may be other variants of monkeypox that might have human-to-human transmission. Because it's worth considering that this is not always something that's easy to tell unless you have a really good handle on the situation in a country where it could be animal spillover or it could be human-to-human transmission. You'd need to have a good grasp of the transmission chain, a good idea of how many cases there are and how they're connected to each other before you could necessarily tell apart consistent long-term human transmission versus continued animal spillover. And these are particularly hard to do if an area doesn't have resources to dedicate, especially in an ongoing SARS-CoV-2 pandemic, to these resources. And Tom gave a bit of a follow-up on that question as well, which is just kind of asking that the particular characteristics of this outbreak that we see, which Nicola outlined really well, in particular, potentially less severe symptoms. We've also heard that there are cases with just one or two poxes, these little marks that you get from the virus. These might also help the virus spread under the radar and might be signs that some of the mutations we see might be contributing to this kind of new clinical presentation, which might make it harder to diagnose, perhaps easier to transmit, which of course would be also adaptive changes for the current outbreak.
Thank you so much, Emma. I think we already got a new speaker. I wanted to respond to a request from Professor Sunit Singh. The floor is yours.
Hi, Christian. It's nice to join this space. I am having two questions and I would like to have a comment on that. Number one, there are very many South Asian countries where it has not been reported so far. I don't know whether due to the lack of testing capabilities or lack of testing programs. So it may be, circulating in population in asymptomatic condition. And as some of the speaker has already told that symptoms range from very mild one to the severe one. So I would like to, have a comment on this. And second question, currently, as we know that SARS-CoV-2 is circulating in population, and we are, and that's an RNA virus, and we are going to have another, attack from DNA virus, and that's monkeypox. So how our immune system is going to take these two insults from different kind of viruses? Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm not sure whether I got all parts of your questions, but I think one part was related to testing capacities. Of course, they vary widely between countries and the level of symptoms that people experience and how that basically influences the reporting of cases. So I wonder whether maybe Nicola Lowe can respond to these questions and talk a bit about surveillance at international level across countries.
Sure. Thank you, Christian. At the moment, of course, with an infection that's sort of spreading newly, it takes some time to develop the testing capacity and it takes time to set up surveillance systems. So it is certain that we are not capturing and recording all the cases that are occurring at the moment. And it will need quite a lot of development and investment to make sure that we can diagnose monkeypox virus in all settings where we need to. Of course, one of those issues is that you require nucleic amplification, acid amplification tests to diagnose that. So that's quite an investment in the technology and the requirements to do those tests. So one of the reasons why probably contributing to the neglect of monkeypox virus transmission in endemic countries in West and Central Africa is that access to molecular diagnostic testing has not been so great. And many of the cases are registered as suspected cases. So the number of confirmed cases that you have has not been so great. So yes, we absolutely need investment and spread and wide access to diagnostics. I think Dr. Singh also asked about asymptomatic infection. And I did allude to one or maybe two cases in which contacts have been diagnosed with monkeypox virus without themselves having symptoms. But I want to stress here that this is a very different situation from SARS-CoV-2, where about a third of people may have an entirely asymptomatic course of infection. What we understand and know from monkeypox virus transmission is that it is unlikely to be transmissible before symptoms emerge. So you have much less opportunity for transmission and for completely asymptomatic cases. The last question was about immunity, and that's something that I'm really not qualified to talk about.
Thank you so much, Nicola. Maybe Aziza, do you want to respond to the question about immunity and co-circulating viruses?
If I got it right, the question was about how does the circulating SARS-CoV-2 influence the immune response to monkeypox virus? Is it right or was it different?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think this is really an interesting question, a great question. And I think we don't have any data so far, but I think as we have it for the COVID-19 pandemic, this outbreak in combination with the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic gives us the unique opportunity to study this and to bring this really into a context and to see whether we could identify any correlates of protection or the other way around, that some immune responses are downregulated and could so induce that the person is more susceptible to a monkeypox virus infection. But to say we don't have the data so far and we need to take the opportunity to get as much data together as possible from that outbreak.
Thanks, Aziza. I'd like to take another question from Twitter using the hashtag from Nino Nikolovsky. He asked about stigma against the MSM community in Switzerland and whether there's reporting or whether that's recorded. Is that something you, Florian Fock, at Aidshilfe Schweiz are involved in to kind of be aware of potential stigma that is developing during the coming months and years in response to this infection?
Well, I have to say in Switzerland, I was quite happy about the cooperation between us, the Swiss gay umbrella organization, and also the Federal Office of Public Health, because we worked really close together about the way of communicating, about the way of wording, so that we can inform the people concerned without stigmatizing the people concerned in the general or the majority of the population. So, and also when it comes to measurements, the federal office is very clear about not to use old public health measures. So I don't see it. And also journalists, actually, they called us a lot and talked with us about how to write about it without stigmatization. So for the beginning, I think it was good. And I think in all of Europe, there were quite professional reactions from many different people involved. How it's going to be in the future, I don't know, of course, but we are ready to fight.
Thank you, Florian. I'd like to give back to the audience on Twitter. There was a request from Xin Yu Yan. Over to you.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I'm Dr. Nguyen from America, and I'm a doctor. So the first case of monkeypox occurred in Mass General Hospital where I train. So I'm a bit interested in this. Thank you for such a wonderful forum on monkeypox. I've been very, very educated on this forum. Thank you so much. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions that I think that needs to be sort of thrown out there. First of all, monkeypox vaccine that we have right now is from smallpox. I agree with that from the speaker who presented the data. However, in the testing of the smallpox vaccine, we have used the monkey who has monkeypox to treat it. So we treated monkeypox vaccine with the smallpox vaccine. And of course, it luckily, it cured it, sort of. Now, we test the data testing of the monkey vaccine on humans. Okay, and we inject it on humans and we have safety data on humans with no smallpox and no monkeypox. The humans that we did safety tested on had no smallpox and no monkeypox. However, the FDA approved the vaccines based on data on monkeypox on Asian macaque labs who have monkeypox. So the first question is, how did these monkeys get monkeypox? So there must be lab storage of monkeypox to induce monkeys to have monkeypox. That's the first question I like to ask.
To answer the question, because it's really a great question. So these studies used MVA to evaluate the protective efficacy against monkeypox virus infection. And there are several different animal models that have been tested that question. And the monkeys have been normally infected via intravenous route, or they have been infected via intranasal infection. And in both ways, it worked quite well. And this is an excellent model to see the protective efficacy. However, there are also other animal models that had been used to evaluate the protective efficacy, the immune responses, and also the safety. And this is the prairie dog model, which is also an excellent model, because the prairie dogs really get severely ill after monkeypox virus infection. And I think all these data together over a long time, I think this has been about 15 years that all these different studies have been evaluated, and really showed that the MVA vaccine is really excellently suited to induce protective efficacy against monkeypox virus infection. Yeah. And of course, humans have not been infected with monkeypox virus, but there is another study from the CDC that is still ongoing. And here the CDC is evaluating the immunogenicity and protective efficacy of that vaccine in Africa, in healthcare worker. And the preliminary data look quite promising. And so this study will be ended up, I think, in summer this year. So we will quite excited to see the data and to see how this really protects. Over.
Thank you, Aziza. I think we head over to the next questions that were raised on Twitter using the hashtag. There were a couple of questions from the perspective of the MSM community about vaccination, whether it would be recommended to get a vaccine abroad if it's not available in Switzerland. I like to open up that question a bit to tests and the vaccines. So as Florian pointed out in his brief talk, in Switzerland so far, no tests or vaccines are freely available. So first I want to give the question to Florian about the developments with respect to vaccine and the recommendations and the view from Aidshilfe Schweiz, and then maybe to Katrin about the developments also research-wise in terms of tests or rapid diagnostic tests and whether that's something we can expect in the coming months. So first to you, Florian.
Thank you. So concerning testing, I mean, it is possible to get a test in Switzerland, but it's at the moment, of course, for different reasons, quite complicated. To the vaccines, we don't think it will be very soon that vaccines are available. It's one thing to, you know, that it's legally allowed to give these vaccines, but it's more difficult to get the vaccines to Switzerland. We see a recommendation in Germany where it's recommended to vaccinate exposed people, but the availability of the vaccine, that's also a big problem. So I would suggest, which is not an official recommendation, if you are a gay man traveling between countries and you have somewhere the possibility to get a vaccination, as a man who has changing sex partners, is maybe in those contexts of sexual and gay culture, I would really recommend to get a vaccination, yes. Somewhere on this planet, if possible.
Thank you, Florian. And maybe Katrin, some thoughts on the development with respect to tests and the availability and production in the future.
Thank you for that question, Christian. And I think it's a great question. I know that many labs are preparing to be ready. We have molecular platforms that can easily test many, many samples. So on that side, we still have to have certain decisions taken by the government. So who can do the test and who is going to pay for? I think that's one of the questions. And on the other side, antigen tests such as fast tests, such as what we had similar for SARS-CoV-2, will definitely be something that is on a high priority in research groups. So I think in Switzerland, we still have to come up with some recommendation regarding testing. But I think the labs, they will be ready if we can provide the diagnostic on a larger scale.
Thank you very much, Katrin. I think we are almost close to the end, so we have time for maybe one or two questions. I also like to address a final question at the end, but I see that Maria Claudia Stockler is a speaker, and would you like to address a question?
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. I am an ID doctor from Brazil, and I happen to have made one of the most cases diagnosed, one of the most, the one case here in Brazil. And it was very astonishing because it was a tiny lesion. So I have a concern because we know lots of bisexual men.
I am.
And so my concern would be with pregnant women, as long as we cannot vaccine them, because it's a live vaccine. Could you hear me?
Yes, sorry, there was an interruption. So the question is whether about the problem that we cannot vaccinate pregnant women and what we're going to do about that.
Yes, that's it. Thank you.
So maybe that's something that can be addressed by Nicola or Aziza?
So perhaps I can shortly jump in. So this is a question we often get about the vaccine. So this is, of course, a live viral vaccine. However, MVA, as the licensed smallpox vaccine, is replication deficient in mammalian. So therefore, this underlines the high safety profile of MVA. And to say we don't have any clinical data from pregnant women, however, we have data from animal models. And so from case to case, it could be that the doctor would decide an off-label use of the vaccine in pregnant women. However, this is really not licensed with MVA, but if we have a look on the safety data, it looks promising.
Can I just come in
on that as well. Of course, it is important to distinguish between different generations of vaccines. So the generation of vaccines that Aziz is talking about are the second, the third generation. And if countries have no access to that and only have first or second generation, then those are vaccines that should not be given, are replication competent. And of course, Claudia is very right to say that pregnant women are a population group at high risk of severe disease from monkeypox. So it's a relevant question. But at the moment, there has been no or very limited spread to outside gay and bisexual men who have sex with men communities.
Thank you, Nicola. Thank you. It's already 7 o'clock. I'd like to finish with the last question, a topic we haven't touched in the last hour, and that's the questions about the public health emergency of international concern. So there is this thing that the WHO can use to announce a public health emergency of an international concern. Of course, that was done for the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic. This week or last week, the WHO decided that the monkeypox outbreak or the global monkeypox outbreak does not constitute a public health emergency of international concern, or not yet. I just like to ask to the all experts that we have here, what are the pros and cons of announcing something, a public health emergency of international concern? Of course, it's about international coordination. Do you think we need more international coordination to respond to this public health threat? Or do you think that at the moment you're basically on the right track and there is enough coordination between countries and also between the developing countries and developed countries? So who would like to start with that?
Perhaps I can start with that. So I think the interaction between the countries is starting to get in the right direction. So before, monkeypox virus was kind of a neglected disease, and there was absolutely no interest to fund research with pox viruses, with other pox viruses, since the bioterrorism threat in from 9/11 went down. So the money for research of pox virus research went really down. So I think this has really to be the start to get more interaction, more collaboration, and to really get more into that funding of pox virus research. And also to look what is else on neglected diseases or pathogens that need to be handled in an international collaboration. I think it's not only monkeypox virus. There are other neglected diseases in low-income countries that should be reflected in a more detailed way in international collaborations. Over.
Maybe I could say a couple of words in addition
to
that.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Both Catherine Sommermatter and I were lucky enough to be part of that expert committee. And the committee consensus statement was that at the moment, monkeypox virus, this multi-country outbreak, should not be declared as a public health emergency of international concern. But that is not to say that it is not at the moment a serious condition and it has public health implications and that there is a risk of international spread and that there is international coordination required. This vehicle of declaring a public health emergency of international concern is quite specific, and the implications there of what would happen if you declared it are very wide ranging in terms of international trade and international travel. So what the committee recommended was completely acknowledged the severity and that there are emergency aspects of this event, but that we should continue to monitor it. There are many things that we still don't know about it for which we need to gather more information, that it should be examined in the near future, and that, in fact, all of the activities that we require to do at international and national and local level, they are already part of recommendations and guidance that the World Health Organization has issued about reporting of infections, the need for surveillance, the need for equitable access to vaccines and treatments, the need for research to evaluate these vaccines and treatments, and for international coordination to talk about prevention and control measures, and the need to have messaging that is non-stigmatizing. And all of those measures can already be done. And it is something that should be looked at again soon. And of course, the decision may change depending on continued spread and a number of other conditions.
Thank you, Nicola. I think we'll stop here. That was a nice summary and ending for the last 1 hour. We're already 5 minutes over seven. With that, I would like to thank the experts and speakers that have participated in our first Twitter Spaces from the MCID. Some of the experts were members of the MCID, but we were also fortunate to have members from outside the University of Bern. Of course, I would also like to thank the audience for participating and raising questions. We plan to have these kind of events for other topics related to multidisciplinary approaches for infectious diseases in the future, and I'm looking forward to welcome you again for the future events. With that, I would like to finish. Thanks again to everyone being involved, and have a nice afternoon.